It is frightening and uncomfortable, but again, it keeps kids healthier and safer if we present ourselves as a reliable source of information, as someone they can come to ask questions when someone shows it to them on the bus.
Hi everyone, this is Dr. Kara Goodwin. Welcome to the Parenting Translator newsletter and podcast. I am beyond thrilled today because I have some of the best guests. I have Dr. Kara Natterson and Vanessa Kroll Bennett, who are the authors of the recent book, This Is So Awkward, Modern Puberty Explained. Thank you so much for being here. Could you both introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do and the book that you have that's out?
Sure. So I'll start. I'm Kara. Kara and I have already bonded. We don't even need to know each other, and we've bonded over the Kara of it all. I'm Kara Natterson. I'm a pediatrician. I came at this work through first pediatrics, and then I flipped into writing books. I wrote books about parenting, books about growing up. I worked on the American Girl Care and Keeping of You line of books, which has been a true joy. And as I really got into that line of books was when I realized there was nothing more than some really wonderful but limited books in terms of helping guide kids and their adults through the journey of puberty. So started a product company that makes really comfortable product that is aimed at solving the pain points of puberty, and partnered with Vanessa on all of it. And now we are a 360 solution to the decade of life that is physical and emotional transformation.
And I come at the world of puberty from having run a girls' sports program for a decade, using sports to build girls' self-esteem. And pretty quickly running that program, I noticed how the girls in my classes, the 8 and 9 and 10-year-old girls, were starting puberty, and everyone was pretty surprised about it, the girls and their parents and the coaches and everyone. So I set out, if we want to help keep kids' self-esteem high over the course of the tween and teen years, a big part of that is giving them reliable, science-based, relatable information about their growing and changing bodies, and giving their parents that information, because it helps only if everybody understands what's happening. So we co-host the Puberty Podcast. We wrote This Is So Awkward together. We had the absolute privilege of speaking at Kara's Kids School in Charlottesville, which was a total joy. And we've been traveling the country for 8 weeks, speaking to schools, almost 50 schools across the country. We've been talking about puberty. So it's a lot of fun and a complete privilege.
So yes, so I saw, you know, Vanessa and Kara, I saw you guys at my kids' school, and you were just so hilarious and also informative at the same time. So I just knew I had to have you on the podcast, and I'm so thrilled to have you here. I have so many questions, and I think I speak, you know, for all of us with younger kids that we're already like pretty worried about it. So when do we need to start talking to kids about puberty? And what do we say to young kids to prepare them and start the conversation, but not scare them about like all this crazy stuff that they have coming in the future?
Yeah. So let's start with removing the fear and the worry. That's the very first thing. So it's completely rational and sane to be concerned about it, but we are going to give you full permission to let that emotion go, because if you're armed with information and you're armed with the gift of knowing that you get to try these conversations lots of different ways over lots of different years, it feels less stressful, right? So that's the first big piece of advice we have, is to the adults in the equation, take a breath, let it go. It's going to be fine. In terms of talking to kids, I'll tee it off and then pass it off to Vanessa. But our feeling is it's never too soon to start conversations about transforming bodies, transforming feelings, transforming friendships and family dynamics, right? Starting to use language, specific language, to identify the anatomical body parts or the way you feel about something are the toes into the water that become the more complicated conversations about puberty.
So for instance, like you can use the anatomically correct words for body parts. With kids in the bath, you can refer to their body parts as vulva and vagina and penis. So we like to say, if you're a household that's talking about pocketbooks and swords, it's time to move to vaginas and penises.
Yeah.
But it's really hard because if you didn't grow up using that terminology, if you don't come from a background where those words were deemed totally normal and acceptable, and instead they were considered, like, quote, bad words, that takes some getting over and some getting used to. And so we just want to reassure people who, for whom that feels really intimidating and challenging. Like, we hear you, we see you, but the research tells us that kids who know the names of all of their body parts are less likely to be victims of sexual predation. So like truly, truly teaching kids the names of their body parts helps keep them safer. The other thing that can start as early as, you know, preschool or kindergarten are conversations about consent. Not conversations about consent in the context of sex, that comes much, much later in life, but conversations about like, hey, can I sit on your lap? Can I hold your hand? Can I have a bite of your sandwich? Those are things where kids learn about their own boundaries, asking for permission to be in someone else's space, requiring permission. So like, we're in between all the holidays right now, and being around relatives who demand hugs or kisses from our kids when maybe our kids don't feel super comfortable doing that, teaching them it's okay to say, no, thank you. Can I give you a high five instead? So those are early conversations that are really the foundation, Kara, for later conversations about puberty, and then later down the road, more complex conversations about sexuality. But those you can have with kids at any age, at any stage.
So the answer is it's never too early.
And it's never too early, and it's never too late, because we hear from people with kids in high school who are like, I have never had these conversations with my kids. Am I too late? And the truth is no, because at any point, by opening up these conversations, what you're saying to your kid is like, I recognize that like you have a body that's growing and changing, and you are in the world in that body, and we can talk about it, even if it feels awkward or uncomfortable for one of us or both of us.
Yes. And probably both of us is usually the situation. So how do we be open and honest with our kids without them having, you know, telling the whole kindergarten what a period is, you know, when they're
parents? You are describing such a classic situation, right? Whether it's on the playground, on the bus, at a play date, there are a subset of kids who are the educators. It is like they are doing a public service by sharing everything that they have learned, and they have no filter for what's theirs to share and what's not theirs to share. They really think they're helping everyone. Oh, I had this question, and now I'm going to share it with you. And frankly, their friends are not prompting them to get this information. So the lesson is that kids need to understand what is news to share and what is not. And there's a fine line between shaming the information, making the information secretive, versus explaining to them why another adult, a parent, grandparent, caretaker, might be a little offended that they gave the information. So, you know, one way that parents can do it is to say, I'm going to talk to you about all this, but this is information that parents often like to talk about with their kids directly. So I'm going to ask that we have this conversation, and if you have questions or want to talk about it again, you come back to me, but not to your friends. And it's a great way of it. You're not making the conversation secretive. You're just emphasizing that it's between the two of you.
Yeah. I mean, I think we get this question not just about talking about periods or any of the many, many conversations we have with kids. We get this question, like, it could be about, because at some point we've got to have a conversation with kids about pornography. At some point, we're going to have conversations with kids about sex. And people are like, I don't want to shame them. But I also, as you experienced, and by the way, as we have both experienced at different times in our parenting journey, our kids have taken it upon themselves to share that information. By the way, I don't think talking about periods is like, I don't think there's anything not age appropriate about explaining to a kindergartner who might have seen you in the bathroom when you have your period, right? Like that may be where the question comes from. There's nothing inappropriate about explaining bodily functions to your kid. It's just, as you say, Kara, every family has different comfort levels with that information. And mostly people worry about what are the next questions they're going to get, because they assume, oh, well, if you talk about periods, then next we're going to talk about sex or something like that. So I think it's just a matter of making sure kids know you're giving them this information. There's nothing shameful or wrong with it. And also it's not for them to educate the entire kindergarten class.
Yeah. Okay. I love that. So explain to them that this is just something we talk about. It doesn't mean it's a secret. It doesn't mean it's there's anything shameful about it. It just is a conversation between you and me. So is there anything to, you know, I've heard this before, but I haven't like seen any research backing this up. Is there anything to the idea that moms should discuss puberty with girls and dads should discuss puberty with boys? And then what do you do if, you know, you are in a single parent situation or one parent just isn't really good at having these conversations? Like, is there anything to that idea?
So we really believe that parents of all genders should be talking to kids of all genders about this decade-long stage of life. As you point out, there are families where there's a single parent and they don't share the same equipment as their kid. It doesn't mean they're not going to have the conversation with that kid, or a household where there's two parents of the same sex and they have kids of different sex and they're going to have conversations with them about it. So I think societally, we've had this situation where people are like, oh, mom should talk to girls and boys should talk to boys because they share the equipment. But honestly, like sometimes parents are really comfortable and good at having these conversations and they don't share the equipment. Or sometimes the parents are really uncomfortable, but the fact is that they need to be part of the conversation because you never know when a kid, you know, kids have kind of flavors of the month with parents and they're more comfortable going to one parent than another. And then all of a sudden it changes and that parent is like out of fashion and the other parent is the one they want to go to. And so everybody needs to be connected to kids and having these conversations with kids, partially just to send the message, there's nothing wrong with these conversations. There's nothing shameful or inappropriate. And if one parent is always having them and the other one isn't, a kid might infer that there's something wrong with talking about these things.
There's also sort of a benefit to having some conversations with the expert, the person who has been through something or lived with something, and some conversations with someone who's on the steep part of the learning curve. So if you've got a dad of a daughter and the dad really doesn't know anything about female anatomy and about periods, and he educates himself, and he's on the steep learning curve, sometimes that conversation resonates more. It's like, we're both learning about this. How awesome is this? How crazy is this? And sometimes going to the one who has lived it is more valuable. So there's benefit across the board to having lots of different types of conversations with all the adults in your life.
And I do think if you are a parent, we've heard from many, many parents over the years who are either a single parent or in a same-sex couple who are raising kids of other genders. And they're like, I want someone of their gender to also talk to them. Then you go out and you find other trusted adults who can be another source of information, another resource for your kid. Because it is nice. Like, I don't know what it feels like to have an erection or wake up in the morning and like be notice that there's a wet dream that happened in the middle of the night. Like, kids do want to ask people who've experienced those experiences. So if you are a parent who's raising a kid and you haven't had the physical transformation that kid has had, find a relative, a friend, somebody in the community who you trust to be another resource for your kid.
Okay, that is so helpful. So it's really helpful to have both parents talk to them. If you need to find somebody of the same gender, that can be really helpful. So in the book, you talk a lot about the research on puberty starting earlier, which we all, I think, have kind of heard about a little bit. And I think this research is just fascinating. So could you talk a little bit about, is puberty really starting earlier? Why? And what does that mean for our kids?
Yes. How's that for a short answer? It is starting on average between 8 and 9 for girls and between 9 and 10 for boys. That is different from a generation or two ago when it started at 11 for girls and 11.5 for boys. And how we measure that is looking mostly at physical shifts that are markers of the path to sexual maturity. So breast growth in females, penile and testicular growth in males. So it's really, when you boil it all down, that's what we're looking at. The studies are not robust. They only look at 3 racial groups of kids. So white or Caucasian, Hispanic or Latino, Black or African American. No other racial groups have been thoroughly investigated in big enough numbers. So that's a travesty. And people are working on correcting that. And also, you know, data is, while we generalize data and we can use statistical powering, there are always going to be people who read studies who say, that's not reflective of what's really going on because of X, Y, and Z. So, you know, there's always going to be criticism of the data, which is why you always keep collecting data to make sure that the data stays relevant. But yeah, puberty starts 2.5, 3 years sooner on average than it did certainly when I was going through it. Now, you all are a little bit younger than I am, and so maybe the time frame had already started to shift. And then the follow-up question we get is why? And the answer is nobody knows that either. But it's some combination of everything that we put into and onto our body. And it's not really everything. It's the things that ultimately disrupt the way hormones work. And there are a bunch of studies now furiously trying to answer what exactly are those things. So that's one bucket. Another bucket is antibiotics, but not the antibiotics you give a kid for ear infections or strep throat. It's the antibiotics in the food supply. That's a low dose, chronic load of antibiotic that's shifting the microbiome in the gut that probably has an impact on hormones. And stress, chronic stress that causes cortisol levels to be high, and cortisol levels being high are associated with an earlier onset of puberty.
It's important for people to know that even though it's starting earlier, it's not going faster, it's actually lasting longer. So the researchers, after establishing the earlier onset of puberty, later studies established that the first period, which is a middle marker of female puberty, has barely moved. On average, it happens a few months earlier than it did a generation ago. So even though it starts earlier, it's lasting longer. Carr likes to say it stretches like taffy. So that means what used to be like a 3 to 4 year sprint through puberty is now basically twice as long, and it lasts almost a decade rather than just a few years in middle school. One of the things that we really encourage people to think about is that even though puberty starts earlier, that they assume that a kid with breast buds or growing penis or testicles is automatically becoming a sexual person and someone who's interested in being sexually active. And the truth is that's not the case. That kids' interest in romantic feelings and then later sexual interest, that still comes later in puberty and adolescence. So your 8 or 9 year old girl is not all of a sudden going to be interested in being sexually active. Your 9 or 10 year old boy is not all of a sudden going to be interested in being sexually active. And that's where the fear sits. I think that's where the discomfort in knowing that puberty starts earlier, that people assume that, like, oh, they're going to run out and start doing all sorts of things. No, they're not. And so we want to remember to treat kids emotionally and socially just as we would 8 and 9 and 10 year old kids, because they are still socially, emotionally those ages.
But the world does sexualize them,
yeah.
Especially girls. You know, girls with budding breasts are sexualized. They are seen through a sexual lens by our society. And It is on us as adults to call that out and stop that behavior because, as Vanessa said, they are not becoming sexual beings for several years to come. It's part of puberty, but it's not an early sign. So why do we as a society ascribe that to kids? I get it, right? So breasts are part of being a sexually mature adult. I get it, but we're calling it. Like, let's all stop.
That's such an important message. And it also makes me think about the influence of social media. So social media is also a big difference from when we went through puberty that is now just such a big part of it. And, you know, I've seen like a series of reels of like, this is what I looked like as a teenager. And it shows like the dorky teenager you would think of. And then it's like, and this is teenagers now. And it shows these girls, you know, wearing midriffs and they're like doing these TikTok dances and like looking perfect. And you're like, what has happened in the past, you know, 20, 30 years since I went through puberty that now teenagers look like that, you know? So could we talk a little bit about the influence of social media and how that plays into puberty?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really complex and multi-layered aspect of raising kids today. I think one of the most important things about talking to kids about social media, I mean, yes, we can delay access. Yes, we can delay giving them a phone, but they're on a million other devices, iPads, computers, our phones, their friends' devices. So we can't prevent them from being exposed to social media. But what we can do is help them become better cultural critics when they are seeing things, right? So a perfect example is a reel of two adolescent girls who have perfectly contoured makeup, who have the latest outfit from Brandy Melville, who've very possibly put on filters and photoshopped whatever they've put out into the world. And so part of it is like making sure kids know that all those things are happening, right? Like they may have spent 2 hours doing their makeup before they decided to film the TikTok. They might have filmed that TikTok 25 times before they did the one that they decided to air. If it's a still photo, they might have photoshopped it and filtered it in a million different ways, right? Like letting them know that what the perfection that they're seeing is not necessarily realistic. And by the way, people talk about girls all the time and girls on social media. Boys are no different. The teenage boys that we talk to like to make sure that people know that the guys who show up shirtless and really like jacked and muscular on social media, they've probably lifted weights and done push-ups before they film the TikTok or they take the photo of themselves so they look more pumped. They've probably used different filters and Photoshopped themselves just as girls have. They've probably removed lots of body hair or put on self-tanner of some sort. So when we talk to kids about social media, it's really critical not to gender it because kids of all genders are trying to create a perfect quote unquote image of how they present themselves. I will say that there are universes where kids present the silly side, the quote ugly side of social media, that unfiltered side, and there are counters to what we see as the sort of like perfection ideal.
You know, it's funny. I'm sitting here thinking we wrote a book called This Is So Awkward. And I think as a parent of kids who have just come out the other side of puberty, I can say to the question you asked, I expected their puberty to look as awkward as mine did. I was awkward. And everyone I knew was awkward. And you're right. This generation is going through this stage of life in a slightly less awkward way, which feels a little weird as the parent who is raising the kid through it. Like, it's not that I want them to feel the way I felt. It's just that I expected that that was their journey. And it's a different journey. And the journey is very much a manicured journey, the way Vanessa described it. But the bottom line is my kids will not have the pictures of themselves that I have of myself from their adolescence because there's a whole world of documentation that looks different to their generation, right? So like they do Photoshop and they do filter and they do this. But they also, I mean, my daughter's favorite, my daughter's 20, her favorite pictures of her childhood self are the weird ones, the ones where she's doing silly things, the ones that are totally not filtered. And I know they're her favorite pictures because she posts those on social media. Like, so I think this whole concept of awkward is very much that, what you're hitting on. I do think we do need to speak to the positives of social media for 1 second. So when you look at marginalized communities, LGBTQ plus kids as a perfect example, there's a ton of data that shows that social media has been not just positive, but life-saving for kids. So pediatricians have done a really, really, really bad job of walking the fine line between the good and the bad of screens and now social media. We're getting better. We're learning from our mistakes. But 10 years ago, we were adamant that screen time was the way to manage all of this. And you could like set a clock by it and that was going to solve all the problems. Nope, 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 nope. Didn't help. It was a good idea. Didn't work. It's quality, not quantity. I mean, quantity matters, but quality and what they're seeing and what they're watching is as important. And rigidity, like in every other corner of life, rigidity doesn't work as well as flexibility and openness. Kids want limits. Kids want rules. They want boundaries. But in the world of social media, you can't just demonize it and say it's all bad. Some of it is really positive. And so being that flexible adult who learns about what they're seeing online, learns about the communities. Yeah, if they're on an eating disorders, you know, down an eating disorders rabbit hole on TikTok, you need to know. But if they're learning how to cook with a community of other kids online who love to cook, wouldn't that be great to know?
Yes. Yes. I love that idea of like not demonizing social media. You know, it's not so black and white. This isn't all evil and it's not all good. And that's what we have to teach our kids. So speaking of things that are online and things that have changed, I know we need to talk about porn because this is a big difference. A lot of us did, you know, porn actually was around when I was going through puberty, but it was very new and like it wasn't everywhere. So how do we start, when do we start thinking about this and how do we talk to our kids about it?
Yeah. I mean, porn has been around for millennia. It's not like it's, you know, a creation of the 21st century. The difference is that the porn of today is so easily accessible online and it's video and it's fed to kids. It's so easily accessed. And then it's not just one video, but it's video after video after video. And free porn, which is what kids are exposed to, it's not the feminist ethical porn behind a paywall. Free porn is often violent and aggressive and non-consensual. So it's scary. It's not just like advanced or inappropriate for them. It can be really frightening for kids to see. So we really encourage parents, because the average age of exposure to porn in this country now is 12. Boys are first, but girls aren't far behind. And the Common Sense Media study that came out in January of 2023 told us that 15% of 10-year-olds are exposed to porn. So knowing that, we have to have conversations with kids about porn. Because we want to get there before the porn does. We don't want porn to define what they imagine sex to be, what intimate relationships to be, what naked adult bodies should look like, right? There's a million ways in which porn can define for our kids what future relationships are. And we know anyone listening feels like has broken out into a cold sweat and feels nauseous at the idea, yeah. Right? Like we're not saying this like, oh, it's so easy. It's no big deal. Like get over yourself. No, we understand it is frightening and uncomfortable. But again, it keeps kids healthier and safer if we present ourselves as a reliable source of information, as someone they can come to ask questions when someone shows it to them on the bus or they see it in school, because 41% of kids have seen porn in school. So, Car, I don't know if you want to talk about like how you toe into these conversations.
Yeah, and I want to give this particular audience a number they can wrap their brain around. So in a class, typical 25 student class in a fourth grade classroom. Three of those kids have seen porn.
Wow.
Right? So that's a number that you can relate to. And we had a parent ask us when we were speaking at one point, they said, but I have a nice kid and my kid has nice friends. One has nothing to do with the other. Porn does not discriminate between, first of all, most kids are nice. Second of all, yeah. Right? Second of all, porn doesn't care, right? That's not how it makes its way to our kids. So how do you toe into it? Well, you start by defining terms. And the first term is sex. If they don't know what sex is, then a conversation about porn, which is a conversation about the visualization of sex and the commercialization of sex, how are you going to have that conversation? So this is a very slow toe in, and it begins with conversations around sex. Do you know what sex is? Right? We have a million conversation starters in our, not a million, but probably conservatively 30, 40, 50 conversation starters about sex, because just getting into that conversation is hard and depends on your personality, your kid's personality, all the circumstances that surround you and your kid. So there are a lot of different ways to describe it. What we talk about when we're on the road and we feel very strongly about is that an inclusive definition of sex is the only way to go. So if the way that you learned about sex was penis and vagina, which is the way most people learned about sex, okay, that's one way to have sex. But you're going to have to figure out a way to describe the broader category of sexual acts, because if you don't include, and this doesn't have to be minute one, but if you don't include oral sex and you don't include anal sex, you're not keeping kids safe. And if you don't talk about masturbation, sex with yourself, you're not being inclusive of all the different kinds of sex. So those conversations may stretch over a long period of time, and it may take you a while to get to porn. Okay, that's fine. When you do get to the porn conversation, you want to start by explaining the why. You know, you want to say why you will have no judgment when they see it, because it's a when, not an if. You want to explain to them that you'll never be mad and you'll always be open to conversation about it. And then you want to explain, and again, the words are going to be different in different households, why it's not the sex you hope they will have. So how do you do that? Again, we have 20, 30, 40 ways into that conversation in the book. It's really going to depend on you and your circumstances. But the most important is the attitude behind it. You're not in trouble. You didn't do anything wrong. You can always come talk to me. As Vanessa always says, even if you're screaming inside your own head, when you're talking to them, you're not sharing any of that angst, because it will find them.
Yeah. Okay. That is scary, but so helpful to know. So I know you guys have to run soon, but just really quickly, could we talk before you have to go about some of the mood changes to expect in puberty, which I think this is so important because we have a huge mental health crisis right now for adolescents. And so I think it's so important for parents to know what is normal in terms of mood changes, when to be concerned, and how do you address those concerns?
So we'll start with our favorite researcher, Louise Greenspan, who says the first sign of puberty is not a breast bud and it's not growing testicles or a growing penis. It's a slamming door. And that is the truth. It is the truth. And it's the truth for all genders. They may not slam it. They may just shut it and be behind it. But moods are very real. They are physiologically connected to the hormone swings of puberty. So puberty is caused not by a nice, slow, steady incline in the sex hormones, but by rapid shifts, high highs and low lows of estrogen and progesterone and testosterone. And those hormones circulate in and around the brain, and they make your brain feel different. They make kids' emotions feel out of control or foreign.
So the hysterical laughter when things aren't that funny, the hysterical tears, when things aren't that sad. The rage when the other person's infraction maybe didn't demand such anger, but the anger is bubbling over. The silence, the desire to retreat and put oneself behind a wall. There's a bunch of different ways that moods present themselves. And our society thinks of like hormonal moods and mood swings as like the purview of females, but males have their own kinds of moods and mood swings. So when you're in a household with a kid who is experiencing that, and by the way, if puberty is starting earlier, then mood swings are starting earlier. You want to have some empathy for it, right? They're shocked, confused, embarrassed, ashamed to be having these out of control mood swings and not totally understand what's going on. So empathy is important. Helping them come down from those mood swings, helping them regulate, having them take a deep breath or take a minute is really important. And also, when we meet them at their very high level of anger or upset or whatever might be going on, if we meet them there, we're not helping them. So when we do that, when we scream back in the face of a screaming kid, that's a chance to take a do-over and apologize and say to them, hey, you needed me to help you calm down, and I wasn't helpful, and I am so sorry. Can I have another chance to be there for you? And that might be the most important tool we have in dealing with kids' mood swings.
Okay, that is so, so helpful. I cannot thank you guys enough. This has been just beyond interesting. I have so many more questions, but I know you guys.
We'll come back.
Please come back. But this has been such a helpful, you know, peek into what I have ahead of me and what I can start working on now. So this has been so helpful. Can you tell my listeners and followers where to find more information? I know you provide so many resources. So just some of the resources that you provide to help parents with this.
Everything is available at modernpuberty.com. You can find links to our podcast, the Puberty Podcast. You can find links to our product site, which is called Oomla, where we make bras and breathable shorts and socks that do not smell, which are a miracle. You can find links to our puberty portal, which are articles written by and for tweens and teens about very specific experiences of going through puberty. You can find a sign up link for our newsletter and a sign up link for information about the health and sex ed curriculum that we are launching in the next couple of weeks to help hopefully solve a lot of informational gaps in schools. So,
Have on our website, we have resources that we love. So books for kids, books for adults, websites, other podcasts, many experts that we respect and have had on the podcast. That's a great place to go. And then on social media, you can find us at Spilling the Puberty on Instagram and TikTok, and at My Oomla. And people can DM us at Spilling the Puberty. They can email us thepubertypodcast@gmail.com if they have questions or episode requests. We love, love, love hearing from people. So don't be shy. Get in touch.
Amazing. You have puberty covered, which is just amazing. This is what all of us parents need. So, so grateful to both of you for being here and for providing all these resources for parents. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you, Kara.
Parenting Translator is a nonprofit organization, so all of these podcasts and the information they provide are given to you for free. If you would like to support our work, please subscribe to this podcast and rate and review it. Thank you so much.